This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wilma Mankiller's life embodies many of the changes and continuing traditions of contemporary Native American culture. Although she spent much of her childhood in an urban ghetto, she has been the chief of the Cherokee Nation since 1985. She's the first woman to hold that position. Mankiller describes her job as part head of a small country, part CEO of a corporation, and part social worker. The Cherokee Nation claims 150,000 citizens and has an annual budget of $78 million. In her new book, Mankiller, she writes about her own life and about the history of her people. Let's start with Mankiller's name. Many people make the mistaken assumption that it's some kind of feminist joke.
The name Mankiller was actually originally like a, it was almost like a military title. It was a given to someone who was kind of like a guardian of semi-autonomous villages that were scattered throughout the Southeast. And this one fellow liked the title Mankiller quite well, and he kept it for his name. And that's who we trace our ancestry back to. So it's my family name.
Has that name given you a lot of trouble because of misinterpretations over the years?
I think that it surprises people because of the name. I'm fairly soft-spoken, and people sort of have an image of what a woman named Mankiller would be like, and I don't think that I really fit their image of that goes along with the name. I've also learned to kind of tease people. If people give me a hard time about it, I tell them it's a nickname and I earned it. And I know it's an unusual name, so I'm not defensive or offended by people's reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I should ask you to explain what the Cherokee Nation is and what its relationship to the United States government is.
Well, it's a government. The Cherokees have a long history of governance, and our relationship to the United States government is a government-to-government relationship. When the U.S. was forming, or when the colonies were forming, they dealt with Indian tribes and groups as separate nations, and that began this sort of government-to-government relationship that still continues today between tribes and the federal government. So I guess you could say, in a way, we're dual citizens, both of the United States and of our respective tribal governments as well.
Were there any objections to a woman taking on the role as chief? And I was wondering if there were any resistance from people who saw themselves as representing tradition when they resisted you.
No, you know, it's actually interesting. I think quite the opposite happened. It was a surprise to me. In the 1983 election, which was the first, during my first election, the only issue in the election was my being female. And that was a total issue in the entire election. And there was incredible opposition because of that. But the people who stayed with me in the 1983 election and who stayed with me through today, 10 years later, have been the older people in the tribe and the more traditional elements of the tribe. I thought that I've always found that fascinating, and my husband and I have talked about it, and I think we've come to the conclusion that maybe older people have a greater sense of history and understand that there was a time when women played a more significant role in the tribe and when there was more balance and harmony between men and women in the Cherokee Nation and Cherokee society.
You said the only issue in that election was your being a woman. What did the people who objected to you being a woman have to say?
Well, one of the things I remember they said was that our tribe, the Cherokee tribe, would be the laughing stock of all the tribes if we had a woman helping to lead the Cherokee Nation. Just those kinds of things, that there was, that there had never been a female chief in our history and that, you know, it wasn't meant to be and all that sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilma Mankiller, and she's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and author of the new book, Mankiller, A Chief and Her People. Well, your family was uprooted when you were a child from Oklahoma to California. This was through the Bureau of Indian Affairs Relocation Plan. How did they convince your parents to move?
Well, I don't think it was that hard to convince my father because there were too many children. We were farmers. We farmed both for our own food and also for to market some of our farm products as well. And there were in the 50s, in the mid-50s, when the Bureau of Indian Affairs approached my father about relocation, there were too many children and simply not enough to go around. My oldest brother, Don, actually quit school to work with my father to help support us, and they would travel to Colorado to cut broom corn or do whatever they could to try to generate enough income besides the farm work to make sure that we had clothes for school and kept ourselves together as a family.
So your father was pretty sure that California would bring a better life?
Well, he had a vision that it would be a better life for his children. That's basically what the Bureau of Indian Affairs told my family and my father, that we would have a better life, that there would be a better life for his children and his family in California. And the better life ended up actually being a housing project in San Francisco.
Did the Bureau of Indian Affairs take care of you when you got to California or help you resettle?
They helped resettle, but I wouldn't exactly characterize it as taking care of us. We were put on a train in Stillwell, Oklahoma, and having left a very rural, isolated community with no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no paved road near our house, and then 2 days later ended up in downtown San Francisco in the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco with no kind of orientation at all. We didn't know what to expect. We couldn't conceptualize a city because we'd never seen one. And the farthest I'd ever been from my home was to Muskogee, Oklahoma. And so there was no preparation, at all for being in San Francisco. And then they were supposed to help us get a flat in San Francisco, and it wasn't there. And the better job that my father had been promised was a job in a rope factory and barely making enough to support us. And again, my older brother worked with my father to help support us. So they facilitated our getting there to California from Oklahoma, but I wouldn't say that they helped us.
So as an 11-year-old girl, you went from rural life in Oklahoma to the San Francisco Tenderloin District, which is the district of prostitution and a lot of alcoholism. Were you frightened when you saw all this? It was so alien to you.
I was very frightened. I remember especially my younger brother Richard and I trying to figure out what the sound of sirens was, because you have to imagine that we had never heard sounds like that, and we imagined that the siren was actually some kind of animal, and we were trying to figure out what kind of animal it was and that sort of thing. And to go to school with children my age and having never used a telephone or not ever rode a bike or used roller skates or any of those kinds of things. So it was a tremendous adjustment.
Were there many other Cherokee or Indians at all where you were?
Well, not too soon after we got to San Francisco, we discovered that there was the San Francisco Indian Center, which became a haven for us. That's where we could go and be with other Native people also who had been relocated, many of them from areas like ours. And so we found a little island in the large city of San Francisco where we could interact with other Cherokees and people from other tribes.
What was the motivation behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation plan?
Well, the motivation, as I see it, was basically to break up tribal communities and quote, mainstream, unquote, Native people. And the government has had a number of policies over the years basically designed to solve the, quote, Indian problem, unquote. And I think that the relocation program was a part of that overall process to try to get people to sort of leave behind who they are as a people and leave a sense of community and tribe and move to the city. Interestingly, the same fellow who was in charge of the Japanese internment, Dylan Meyer, was also in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation program for a time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilma Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and author of the new book, Mankiller, A Chief and Her People. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Wilma Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation and the author of a new autobiography. Tell us how you got politicized. It was about the time of the Native takeover of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco.
For me, it was kind of like a watershed. All of a sudden, people were articulating things that I had felt but didn't know how to articulate, talking about treaty issues, about providing adequate health care and educational benefits for Native people and that sort of thing. And so right after that, my whole family became involved in the Alcatraz Island occupation. Right after that, I volunteered to work for the Pitt River Tribe in California and worked for them for a number of years as a volunteer and just sort of got involved in the whole thing.
Now, I believe your father died during the occupation of Alcatraz.
That's correct. My father, who was sort of the glue that held our entire family together, died in 1971. And during the Alcatraz occupation, he died from complications as a result of being on dialysis from kidney failure.
He was buried in Oklahoma, where you had lived before moving to California. Did he express a wish to be buried there? Was it always understood that that would happen?
It was always understood that that would happen. In fact, interestingly, when we got on the train in Stillwell to leave for California, my father told my mother, "I don't think I'll ever come back until I come back to be buried." And he always wanted to come back to visit and just was never able to do so. And so he was very prophetic.
Was the funeral the first time that you went back to Oklahoma?
No, I'd actually visited my sister, my older sister, just as a family visit and not an extended stay or anything before coming back for the funeral. But the funeral really, even though I'd been home before that, really was kind of a coming home, because when my father came home, even to be buried, a part of us came home, and then soon after my mother started thinking about coming home, one of my sisters came home, and then I came home in 1977.
Are you living on the same land that you had lived on before you left Oklahoma?
Yes, I sure am. In fact, I can sit on my porch and look across the way and see flowers in the springtime that bloom that my grandfather probably saw as he walked around our land. And you'd go to the spring where I gathered water for drinking water for our house as a child, and where my grandfather and grandmother got their drinking water. So there's a great sense of history and family in the place where I live.
How did you get the land back, and what had become of it in the years that your whole family was on the West Coast?
Well, it's actually an interesting story, because my father had been tempted to sell it several times through the years, and he desperately needed the money at many, many periods of time in his life, and he could just never bring himself to sell it, and even though he needed the money very badly. And so he kept it for his children, and I'm very, very grateful that he was able to do that. So I live there. My mother lives very near me, and then I have a sister who lives near me as well.
There was a car accident that you write in your book changed your life. This was, I believe, in 1979.
Right.
And you were actually hit by a very close friend of yours. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, I don't know what the odds are against something like this happening, but they have to be awfully great. I was in graduate school and was trying to live on a small scholarship and a graduate fellowship, and so I asked the people at the Cherokee Nation if I could do some contract work. And so I was driving from my home, took a day off from school, and was driving from my home to the Cherokee Nation in Tahlequah, and I guess she was in a hurry. She was always drove too fast, and there were three cars in a line, and she was in a hurry, and she passed these cars and didn't see me coming up a hill. And so I guess we saw each other for a split second, because my car turned a little to the right, and so did hers, to try to avoid one another. We hit one another head on, and she was killed, and I, you know, had many, many injuries. And it was very hard for me, because not only was I injured very badly and all that, but I, she her death had a profound effect on me. I had for a long time, I guess, survivor's guilt. I didn't know that it was survivor's guilt, but, you know, I felt very, very badly about her death. In fact, they didn't tell me for about 3 weeks in the hospital that she had even that anyone had died, nor did they tell me that it was Sherry. Her husband would come and see me in the hospital, and I'd say, "Well, where's Sherry?" And it was odd that he would come without her. And then finally, one day, I think they decided that eventually I was going to get out of traction and all that, and read newspapers or talk to people, and someone would tell me. So they told me about her death. It was a very difficult time for me. And so I, during that period of recovery after the accident, I had a profound change and matured a lot, leveled off a lot.
Well, you write that you, during this period of recovery, adopted what the elders call the Cherokee approach to life. What is that?
Well, I think the Cherokee approach to life is being able to continually move forward with kind of a good mind, and being able to not focus on the negative things in your life or the negative things that you see around you, but focus on the positive things and try to look at the larger picture and keep moving forward.
You came very close to death in the car accident, and you write that during that accident you lost any fear of death.
Yes, I did, and it's a special gift, I think. Having been so close to death, which, by the way, was the most wonderful feeling I've ever had in my life. It was more profound than childbirth, or better than, you know, being better than the deepest love I've ever had with a man. It was an incredible, unbelievable feeling of unconditional love, and very, very tempting to go on to death. And it was kept me, I think, from going on to death was thoughts of my children somehow or another came in that whole process. And then in a physical sense, there was a nurse straddling me in the ambulance who was beating on me and keeping my attention and keeping me from slipping away. But what was going on in my mind really was this sort of battle between whether I should just go on with this wonderful feeling or come back. And so it did have an impact on me. It made me not at all afraid of death. And also, I think, helped me understand my own insignificance in the totality of things as well.
You weren't feeling any pain after the accident? You were just feeling this warmth and good feeling.
No pain at all. No pain at all. I was so far away from physical, you know, my physical self, I think, at that time, that I wasn't even aware that the woman was, you know, was on top of me trying to keep me alive until someone actually told me later. And so it was just sort of fighting this little battle of whether I should go on with this enormous feeling of universal love. And of course, I thought I was the only one who had ever experienced that until I later read books and talked with people who had also gone through the same experience or similar experiences.
Do you feel that you made a decision at some point to live?
Yes, I do think I made a decision. And I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but I remember that my two daughters came into the process somewhere or another in my mind or during that period of time, and that I probably made a conscious decision to live at that point.
Now, are there any Cherokee ideas or traditions that fit with the experience that you had?
No, the only thing that's happened that's kind of interesting to me, and I've not had time to really reflect on it, is that this Cherokee medicine man, who's a contemporary medicine man, had a dream about a kind of like a, I wouldn't call it a vision, I would call it a very intense, clear dream, that there would be a woman who would sort of rise from the ashes, so to speak, and who would help lead the Cherokee Nation. And when he met me, he was very startled because I looked like the woman. And so that's the only thing that, you know, that I can relate to that experience at all so far.
Well, it's pretty remarkable. You had this car accident in which your whole body was shattered, your whole face was shattered. And then after that, you lost a kidney to kidney disease. You had a form of MS that in which you temporarily lost some nerve control. It's just amazing to me that after this, you were able to become chief, to maintain your energy and focus your energy and be a leader.
Well, I think it's actually because of those things that I've been able to be a leader. And in a strange kind of way, sometimes very terrible events can have a positive side effect. And what those experiences taught me, I think, is that they taught me to be extremely strong, and they also taught me to look at the larger things in life rather than focusing on small things. And and it's also awfully, awfully hard to truly rattle me, after having, faced my own mortality a couple of times. So the things that I learned during those experiences actually enabled me to lead. Without those experiences, I don't think I would have been able to lead. I think I would have been, got caught up in a lot of nonsensical kinds of things.
Your family is all back together now in Oklahoma?
All of my brothers and sisters except two are in Oklahoma. I have a brother, John, who lives in San Francisco, and my brother, Don, who gave me the kidney and who the book is dedicated to, lives in Escalon, California. But both are very involved in the family at home, and Don has a home in Oklahoma as well as California and travels back and forth between the two of them. So we've sort of come full circle from where we started out. We started out in this little tiny rural isolated community in eastern Oklahoma, went to San Francisco, and then came full circle back to our homes again.
Wilma Mankiller, her new memoir is called Mankiller. She's the chief of the Cherokee Nation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.